Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 15, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call and our monthly update on the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to today's call two experts. They are Julius L. Lozier. He's of counsel at Winston & Strawn. He'll be joined by Professor Todd J. Zawicki. He's the Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. They're going to go back and forth, each addressing several topics. So it's almost a lightning round, moving from topic to topic. But when they are done presenting on several different issues, we will be turning to the audience for questions. So please be thinking of your questions in advance. With that, I think we're going to begin with Jerry Lozier. So, Mr. Lozier, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Dean. First, let me remind everyone that every month we put together a written summary of developments at the CFPB, summary is posted on the Federalist Society website. This month was a very busy month. There were about 38 different developments. We're going to talk about eight or nine of them that we think are particularly significant. One is the first one I want to talk about actually is about a Wall Street Journal editorial that appeared yesterday, and it had to do with the CFPB concern about indirect auto loans. We have discussed this in the past. But just to refresh everyone's memory, the background on this is that auto loans are a top concern at the CFPB. Auto dealers, you may know, arrange auto loans in which the creditor is really normally a bank or a finance company. The dealer is compensated for that work based on the amount of the interest rate on the loan, which gives an incentive to the auto dealers to negotiate a higher interest rate. The CFPB is convinced that when that type of arrangement is out there, that lenders somehow discriminate against minorities, and somehow minorities end up paying higher interest rates than non-minorities. The major problem the CFPB faces in this, one of the major problems, is that there is not a lot of data available. In fact, there's none available on the race of borrowers on auto loans. There is mandated in the home mortgage lending area a requirement that lenders disclose and file with regulators the race of loan applicants and borrowers, but that's the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act requirement, and that is not applicable to automobile loans. So the poor CFPB is stuck with a problem. How is it going to detect discriminatory lending in the auto loan field? And it has come up with a formal methodology that uses an applicant's last name and census tract as a means of estimating whether the person is a minority or not. And this is, some people feel that it may be sort of silly, but that is the position of the CFPB. And the Wall Street Journal editorial yesterday was about the follow-up on a December 2013 settlement that the CFPB reached with Ally Bank, in which Ally Bank paid $80 million to the CFPB to be dispersed to minority loan applicants who had been unlawfully discriminated against and paid higher interest rates, supposedly. The editorial in the journal yesterday is very tough. It essentially, it uses the language, quote, extorting damages, naming anyone who's been damaged. It points out that 16 months after this settlement was reached, not a dime has been paid to any victim. And the reason for that is that the CFPB is merely guessing at the ethnicity of people, and therefore it cannot really identify any real victims. The CFPB, in its defense, is quoted in the editorial as saying, well, excessive outreach is required and, quote, consumer-facing materials, unquote, are being finalized. But the bottom line is the Wall Street Journal suggests, well, perhaps if the CFPB isn't sure whether someone that they guess is a minority is a minority, they should pick up the phone and call them and ask them whether they're a minority, which I suppose is sort of tongue in cheek. But anyway, we didn't want to go without mentioning that it's not normal that the CFPB gets Wall Street Journal editorial. This was the lead editorial yesterday coverage, so we thought we didn't want to pass that up and not mention that. Todd?
Well, we had a lot of activity on our old favorite Operation Choke Point, the initiative by the FDIC that resulted in targeting high-risk businesses originally for reputational risk. As we mentioned last month, the FDIC seemed to be disclaiming Operation Choke Point, but it's still unclear what's going on, and there's still a lot of activity trying to figure out who's doing what with respect to it. So I've got several updates on that, which is the first is on March 18th, the Senate Budget Committee approved a budget amendment proposed by Senator Mike Crapo that would defund the Department of Justice's Operation Choke Point program. And so that's one of the agencies that's been involved in Operation Choke Point that is actually on budget. A second activity was that this past month, on March 24th, FDIC Chairman Martin Grunberg testified and decided to throw under the bus a bunch of FDIC examiners. As Grunberg said that the whole Operation Choke Point thing was just a big misunderstanding, and that they had given guidance with respect to reputational risk, but that unfortunately some FDIC bank examiners had misinterpreted the guidance that they had given, and applied it as a blanket rule and not on the kind of case by case basis that they supposedly were supposed to do. And Chairman Duffy of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations asked him, why haven't they fired some of these people who who misinterpreted this this guidance supposedly with respect to this? Last week on April 8th, there was a letter from several House Republicans to Chairman Cordray of the CFPB referring to all this and also asking Director Cordray, quote, to publicly disclaim your agency's past, present, and future involvement in Operation Choke Point or any similar operation, publicly issue something to your employees to basically that explains what their policy should be with respect to this, and then confirm to the House Financial Services Committee. So obviously both the House and Senate still continue to be very actively involved in overseeing Operation Choke Point in trying to get to the bottom of what's going on, even as it seems like at least there's signals that supposedly there's a withdrawal on it. Related to that, on March 27th, the Department of Justice posted on its website a blog post in which it gave its own rendition of Operation Choke Point and basically said it doesn't know what anybody's talking about in terms of legitimate businesses that haven't done anything wrong getting cut off from services, financial services. And in their argument, they actually define and refer to what has traditionally been a sort of standard operating procedure, which is the DOJ gives a couple of examples of situations in which payment processors were actually intentionally or grossly negligently processing payments that they knew or should have known were fraudulent payments on an ongoing basis, and tried to say that that's all Operation Choke Point is a fairly routine use of enforcement powers to go after payment processors who are essentially laundering fraudulent payments on behalf of other parties. Now, of course, that has never been, and certainly isn't, what people have been concerned about with what is actually going on with Operation Choke Point, which is what seemed to be this this hit list of industries that were identified as suspect industries, including payday lending and firearms and that sort of thing, and the way in which it was interpreted as a blanket reputational risk idea of shutting off these industries and firms in these industries from service. So while the DOJ, and in fact they actually tried to claim that Operation Choke Point was merely this effort to protect consumers from these particularly egregious type situations. The final development on this is that as the FDIC is retreating from their blanket Operation Choke Point, and as the DOJ is trying to narrow what it claims is its role in Operation Choke Point to relatively non-controversial ways or practices, on March 26th, the CFPB jumped into this fray with what seems to more or less potentially be a shifting of Operation Choke Point activities from the FDIC to the CFPB, and claiming that the that there were these payment processors who were involved in fraudulent activities by debt collectors, and that the payment processor should have known of the customers' wrongdoing by virtue of high chargeback volumes. And basically what seems to be going on here is that the CFPB now, which has so far been relatively silent with respect to Operation Choke Point, at least in the public eye, seems to be perhaps dipping its toe into the water. It's never been quite clear what the CFPB's link to Operation Choke Point has been, if there has been any link, but at least in this case involving this lawsuit against these debt collectors in Atlanta, it seems that the CFPB is now expanding its reach to the activities that the FDIC and the DOJ seem to be doing with respect to their Operation Choke Point activities. And it may be that this is an area to watch as the CFPB moves further into it. Now, of course, if the goal here is to essentially attack businesses that are unpopular with this administration, such as firearms dealers, payday lenders, and the like, as we've talked about on numerous occasions, the CFPB, because of the lack of typical oversight processes and the like, may be a more politically insulated agency that could carry out the Operation Choke Point activities that have been previously done by other agencies. So, for example, as I mentioned at the outset, the DOJ is now subject to a committee resolution, at least, that would remove budget authorization for the DOJ to spend money on Operation Choke Point activities, whereas, of course, the CFPB, by being completely off budget, doesn't have that sort of constraint on its activities. So I'll throw it back to you, Jerry.
Thank you, Todd. I was also going to talk about a U.S. District Court decision affecting the CFPB that came out last month, and it's fairly interesting. Folks may remember that the CFPB sued ITT Educational Services, a for-profit college, for allegedly misleading students about the costs and benefits of enrolling. And ITT filed a motion to dismiss, which was acted upon last month by the U.S. District Court in Indianapolis. And ITT had argued that, first of all, that the CFPB was a, quote, unconstitutional entity because the president does not have the authority to remove the director of the CFPB except for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. And therefore, the ITT argued the CFPB lacked standing. The court disagreed and concluded that the director of the CFPB's powers are not so great that the inability of the president to remove him or her at the president's whim undermines the president's ability to take care that laws be faithfully executed. ITT was also accused of by the CFPB of engaging in unfair and abusive practices. And abusive is a term that appears for the first time in the Dodd-Frank Act. And ITT argued that that term was unconstitutionally vague. The court disagreed and said that the Dodd-Frank Act, which does have somewhat of an explanation of the term, the Dodd-Frank Act provides the minimal level of clarity to satisfy due process. Finally, ITT argued that it is not engaged in providing financial services and therefore is not subject to CFPB jurisdiction. The court disagreed and said that ITT was providing financial advisory services to its students and was a service provider to third-party lenders and therefore was subject to CFPB jurisdiction. So it was a victory for the CFPB. Todd?
Perhaps the biggest news that came out of the CFPB directly this month was the announcement on March 26th of what's referred to as the CFPB's movement towards payday lending rules to regulate payday lending, although they actually sweep further than payday lending. Now, one of the interesting things, of course, is the CFPB touts itself as being completely immune to politics and that the reason why it has to be insulated from the president's removal power and the congressional budgetary power is so that you don't have politics infecting its activities. But, of course, the announcement was made in tandem with President Obama, who seemed to know a lot about what this completely independent agency that is completely apolitical knew was going to be coming out. And the president endorsed this very heavily, what the CFPB was proposing to do on these payday lending rules. But the rules were, as you know, mentioned, payday lending rules, and that seems to be the primary target. They haven't actually released the rules, but they're describing what they're planning on doing. And they focus on two basic ideas, which is first, a so-called ability to repay before a lender makes a loan, and second, certain collection activities. Now, under the ability to repay provisions or so-called efforts to prevent debt traps, it would require the lender to determine at the outset that the consumer can repay the loan when due without reborrowing, that they would have to verify the customer's income, major financial obligations, and borrowing history to determine whether or not after they repaid the loan, the consumer would be able to we'd be able to repay the loan after covering all their other major expenses. And then on the back end, they provide an effort for customers to supposedly escape so-called debt traps by creating a cooling off period between loans after a certain amount of time, or, as I understand it, essentially converting a loan to an installment loan if a customer is not able to repay it after a certain amount of time. The second limitation has to do with payment collection practices, which would require the lender to provide customers with 3 business days in advance before debiting the customer's account to be able to pay the loan, and it restricts the number of efforts to try to collect on the loan, so that after 2 consecutive unsuccessful withdrawal attempts, the lender would not be allowed to make further attempts unless the customer provided a new authorization. What's interesting, of course, is that this had been expected for a while, that these ability to repay type rules would come in. And this is also interesting because it seems to be the template that the CFPB is likely to apply to other loans as well, whether in here they certainly talk about high interest in installment loans, but also vehicle title loans, deposit advance products, and certain other types of loans, and perhaps provides a template down the road for overdraft protection regulation. Now, of course, there are 2 things missing from this investigation, which is it's based purely, it seems, on some CFPB studies that simply do not support what the CFPB is doing here. As I've mentioned in a couple comments, you can find on my website with Michael Flores, they base this on a certain research done by the CFPB, which is inherently interesting, but does not in any way support the claim implied by the CFPB here that, in fact, access to these loans is welfare-reducing for consumers. And that's the question the CFPB said they were going to look at before they started thinking about regulating payday lending, which is, what are the alternatives for customers or for consumers who use these products? Because it's widely expected that the effect of this will be to end these products effectively, because for a $300 loan, it simply isn't feasible to try to collect the kind of information to do the kind of underwriting that the CFPB wants to do here. And so as a result, it's likely that those small loans will simply disappear. Of course, one of the other ironies of this is that consistent with everything else that we've seen in Dodd-Frank, in the end, the only lenders who are going to be left standing by this are very large lenders, very large institutions. Small companies will almost certainly disappear from this market, and that's consistent with the general trend of Dodd-Frank that we've talked about and the general trend of CFPB regulation, which has been to drive smaller institutions out of business, whether community banks, in this case, small payday loan companies, debt collectors, and the like are all being squashed by this. But fundamentally, they do nothing to address the fundamental question that a regulator would want to know, which is what's going to happen to these consumers who no longer can get access to these high-cost credit products. And as Michael Flores and I have written, that's the fundamental regulatory issue here that the CFPB simply is not considering in issuing these particular rules, in which case either they know that these rules are not workable and they don't care, or they simply don't know that they're not workable, which is obviously an even bigger problem. The second issue here is that it implies that defaults on payday loans are the result of an inability to pay, which is, of course, simply not true. That consumers seem to be quite savvy about payday loans. Payday loans are an unusual product, and a lot of these small unsecured loans are an unusual product in that they essentially have a free default option, which consumers know and often do exercise, which is that they are not sued to enforce these usually, that sort of thing. A lot of defaults are simply because they choose not to repay them, and the only reason why consumers roll over payday loans primarily is to be able to maintain access to payday loans in the future. And so again, we have this sort of bias of the CFPB in thinking that defaults are caused purely by an inability of a consumer to a repay, or a lack of understanding by the consumer of what they're getting themselves into, which isn't the case here. Finally, what we see here is a completely unproven assumption, which is that somehow installment loans are better for consumers. But as we know, these are often consumers who have you know, are not financially, I'm not sure responsible is the right word, but basically they have trouble managing their finances. And it doesn't become any easier for them to manage their finances if you make them make a monthly payment on a loan over a long period of time rather than having balloon payments necessarily. There seems to be this assumption in a lot of this literature that simply putting somebody on a repayment schedule means they'll actually meet the repayment schedule. But as we know from studies on installment loans, in particular, a recent study by Tom Durkin and Greg Ellighausen, one of the biggest problems for installment loans is that you have to track down consumers to make their payments every month. And so this just pretending like consumers are going to be on a repayment schedule doesn't mean they'll actually carry through on it. So this whole thing seems to be based on certain understanding, certain assumptions, without any empirical evidence to suggest that they're actually making consumers better off as a result of this. It's just floated at this point. It seems to be this is the direction they're headed in. There's still the Sabrifa panel that has to meet that, but at this point, most people are treating this as a fait accompli where the CFPB is targeted where they want to go, and it's just a matter of getting there. Jerry?
Thanks very much, Todd. The next thing I was going to talk about is a terrific example of executive overreach, I think. I know the Federal Society monitors things that we consider executive overreach, and this really, I don't know how to describe this any other way. Last month, the CFPB adopted a formal policy it had proposed before to make, at the option of consumers, public, to make public the complaints they file with the CFPB, the full text of the consumer complaints. Historically, the CFPB consumer complaint database has only identified the name of the company being complained about and the product type involved. But now the entire text at the option of the consumer will be made public on the CFPB website. The CFPB will remove personally identifying information to protect the consumer, but it will not do anything to protect the firm complained about. The firm being complained about will have an option of, within 60 days, selecting one of a set list of so-called structured response options. So there will be options prepared by the CFPB, and you can select one of the boilerplate options, but you cannot actually defend yourself to explain yourself if your firm being complained about. So obviously, this has two extraordinarily overreaching implications. Number one is we will have the federal government publishing on an official government website quite likely defamatory remarks that are inaccurate, baseless, but nonetheless defamatory. And second, the person being defamed will not have any genuine, real opportunity to defend itself. And I don't know how you characterize that in any other way other than as overreach. But Todd, I will turn it back to you.
So my last thing for this month is a brief one. There's sort of continued efforts to deal, on the Hill at least, to deal with the ongoing train wreck of the qualified mortgages rule that the CFPB promulgated. As is well known, the qualified mortgages rule has dramatically increased the risk and complications of making mortgages. It's caused many mainstream mortgage companies to leave the market, especially as we talked about previously. Both Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan have announced that they are not going to make loans to low-income communities anymore because of the risk of liability. And there's been efforts on Capitol Hill and legislators to push back. And one issue that arose this month was a letter from Senator Mitch McConnell, Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, and Dean Heller from Nevada, to try to pare back the qualified mortgages rules, and in particular to try to expand the exception for rural for rural lenders. And so the Dodd-Frank Act prevents or has special rules dealing, I shouldn't say prevents, permits special rules for rural mortgages that wouldn't qualify with the qualified mortgages rule for others, including such things as balloon payments. Basically what the senators asked in their letter was to expand the rural exception so as to allow to apply in more situations to make it more possible for banks to actually be able to make mortgages. This won't be the last we've heard on it. As we know, the qualified mortgages rule is really gumming up still the works with respect to getting mortgages out into the market, and this at least has some bipartisan support. Jerry?
Todd, I just have a couple of more things to mention briefly. One is that at the end of the month, the American Bankers Association and the Consumer Bankers Association wrote a joint letter to the CFPB commenting on the CFPB's request for information about a so-called Safe Student Account Scorecard that it was proposing, the CFPB was proposing to provide to colleges and universities. And this scorecard would be used by colleges and universities to solicit information from financial institutions wishing to, quote, partner, unquote, with the colleges or universities to issue financial services to students. And the scorecard would require or urge that the colleges and university ask for specific information on fees and features. The letter from the ABA and the CBA suggests that the problem with this scorecard is it is encouraging colleges and universities to only deal with financial service providers that offer a one-size-fits-all standard type of product. And the letter points out that when the Dodd-Frank Act was pending in Congress, there was a provision in the bill or proposed in the bill to authorize the CFPB to design or require standard products, and Congress rejected that authority for the CFPB. So this is sort of like a backdoor way for the CFPB to design a sort of a standard deposit product for college students. The other thing I just want to mention very briefly, the budget of the Federal Reserve Board, actually the auditor's report, Deloitte & Touche audits the Federal Reserve Board every year. And people may remember that theoretically the CFPB is a division of the Federal Reserve Board, but it's beyond the control of the Federal Reserve Board. But the Federal Reserve Board is required to fund the CFPB at an amount equal to 12% of the operating expenses of the entire Federal Reserve System, which includes 12 Federal Reserve banks beside the board itself. What was interesting and worthy of note was that the financial statements audited by Deloitte & Touche this year showed that the Federal Reserve had transferred $563 million to the CFPB to fund the CFPB budget for this year. And what's particularly noteworthy is you can compare that to the budget of the Federal Reserve Board itself, not including the 12 Reserve banks, which is the board itself, and that its operating expenses, the board's operating expenses itself, were $597 million. So you have $563 million that went to the CFPB and $597 million to fund the Federal Reserve Board itself, which has been around for more than 100 years. So it kind of suggested to me a rough equivalence in the cost of running these two agencies, which was somewhat surprising. I had assumed that the CFPB would be a much smaller operation than the operations of the Federal Reserve Board. But, Dean, that's all I have.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. That's a pretty comprehensive, report, although you mentioned at the outset there might be 30 or so noteworthy events. We've covered quite a few of them. I appreciate that. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts or even both of them, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me announced to folks that we will have another teleforum conference call. It hasn't been scheduled yet, but it will focus on an arbitration study fairly recently released by the CFPB. That study finds, I think at least in part, that or concludes that arbitration clauses in certain contracts with consumers work to the detriment of those consumers. So that will be the focus of an upcoming, soon-to-be-announced teleforum conference call. Today, of course, we're talking about the CFPB more generally. I think our experts are happy to take your questions on any of the topics they've discussed or even beyond those topics. We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join that queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's take our first call.
Hi, Larry Callahan from lovely Northern California. Jerry, with a non-lovely question, almost one that harkens back to the old term, much foolishness. It wasn't obviously the most important thing you spoke about, but interesting. The one on the defamatory comment issue, has there been any reaction from the Hill or the board about this? It just seems like something that it shouldn't be that hard to deal with. Other things that could be really controversial, I don't get this one.
Larry, first of all, it's good, nice to hear your voice. And I know that they're always beautiful in San Francisco. But I have not heard of any reaction from the Hill yet. But I know the ABA president, Frank Keating, a couple of days ago sent a very tough letter to the CFPB. And I think from what I'm hearing, you know, the intelligence I pick up, there is enormous industry discomfort and anger about this. And so I think it would not surprise me that we will start hearing complaints to the Hill, and I will even stick my neck out on this and say I'd be surprised if the CFPB doesn't back away from this in some way, because it's such an outrage that even I don't know how it seems so indefensible that you're gonna, you know, publish one side of a story and not the other, and it's amazing.
Thanks, Jerry. I'm glad I didn't overreact.
Again, our lines are wide open now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me make another announcement about calls that are, in fact, scheduled. Tomorrow is our next scheduled teleforum conference call at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. That, in what has become a pretty highly visible challenge to the EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to hear oral argument tomorrow morning. Our Teleforum will include Rob Gassaway, a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. He's going to attend oral argument, and then tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, report back to us on our Teleforum conference call. Next week, we'll host calls on Johnson versus United States. That's a Supreme Court argument on Monday on whether possession of a sawed-off shotgun is a violent felony under one federal statute. On Tuesday, we'll be talking about the EPA waters of the U.S., and on Wednesday, in Horn versus USDA, another Supreme Court case, the raisin growers returned to the Supreme Court. Those are Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, respectively. Check our website for updates. And today, of course, we're talking to Jerry Lozier, Professor Todd Zwicky. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask a question, and then if we don't have questions, further questions from the audience, we'll adjourn. I'm just curious from either one of you, maybe particularly with regard to the payday lending calculations, is there a presumption underlying the CFPB's actions that payday lending is per se a bad thing, that is, that it never serves a legitimate consumer interest, and is the goal here to, you know, not ban payday lending outright, but to sort of regulate it out of existence? And if that is the goal, what happens to those folks who are able to, the consumers, that is, who are able to use payday lending advantageously and need it as consumers?
That's exactly the issue, Dean, which is, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this is that Dodd-Frank itself, in setting up the CFPB, specifically provides that CFPB shall impose no national usury ceiling. And I think the logic was that that sort of effectively blanket bans on products by imposing a usury ceiling was not the way they wanted to go. As we've seen, for instance, the Department of Defense has essentially been able to do that through the Military Lending Act, which is, you know, under a different jurisdiction, where they're basically regulating products out of existence with a 36% cap. And, but what we're seeing with this is that there are many ways in which a regulator can get rid of products that they don't like. And here, what they're using is basically the technique of the rollovers, and by imposing unrealistic underwriting requirements, which presumably they're going to impose the same thing eventually. I think this is the template for most notably overdraft protection, which operates in a way that's very similar to a payday lending, which is overdraft protection is essentially done without underwriting. It basically is offered to people primarily who have direct deposit, for instance, on the assumption that their money is good, that the money is going to come in, right? And these small dollar products only work if underwriting costs are nominal. And so what they're doing here is obviously imposing costs on these products that will make them impossible for them to do it. Now, what we know is this backfires on consumers many ways, obviously by taking away the product. But number two, what we also know from history is one way to avoid these things is just make consumers borrow more money. Now, how you make a consumer better off, if you're concerned, as they are, in a paternalistic way, how you make somebody better off by forcing them to borrow $700 or $800 or $1,000 when all they need is $300, that's never really been explained, but we know that that's what history tells us about what happens when we engage in these kind of regulations, is the size. One way of making loans is just increase the size of the loan the borrower has to take out in order to deal with the fact that you're doing this underwriting, which really isn't relevant to the product in this situation. But you ask exactly the right question, Dean, which is payday lending specifically is a very challenging product. And there are dozens and dozens of academic papers analyzing all the various components of payday lending, whether it makes consumers better off or worse off. And the answer is it depends. And it depends on the consumer. It depends on why they're using it and that sort of thing. But there's very little evidence, I'd say no evidence, that suggests that completely taking away payday lending, which is what this would end up doing because of the underwriting requirements, will make consumers better off in the long run. And if you combine that with taking away all the alternatives to payday lending, which is the direction they're headed, which is getting rid of overdraft protection, which is the closest complement to payday lending for most people, but also the other products that they talk about in here, there's really no reason to believe that that'll make consumers better off, and that people use payday lending because for them it is cheaper than the alternatives, which includes pawn shops, it includes eviction, it includes bounced checks. There's a lot of things that happen to consumers, and a responsible regulator would actually think through what does happen to consumers and do you make them better off by restricting access to a particular product. And of all the studies the CFPB has done, all they've ever really looked at is the rollover behavior of consumers, but they've never actually tried to determine what the alternatives are for consumers if you take away these access to these products.
Jerry Lozier, anything on this point?
No, other than I agree totally with Todd. I, the only thing I would add is the alternatives that these poor consumers are going to have that Todd did not mention will be loan sharks. And, so often these well-intended progressive efforts end up hurting the people they intend to help, and this is so clearly an example of that, it seems.
I'll stipulate that our phone call representative from Chicago is probably more tuned to attuned to those particular entrepreneurs than the rest of us.
We do have a
but that is true.
We do now have a couple questions pending from our audience, so let's turn back to our audience now.
Hi, this is Jody Herman in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a George Mason alum, so Professor Zwicky, it's been nice to hear from you today. My question is, I wanted to know if anybody was aware of any other challenges to the CFPB jurisdiction on the grounds that the company is not engaged in providing financial products or services, and whether any of those challenges have been successful or unsuccessful.
Jerry, do you know?
You know, I want to say there have been other challenges, but I don't believe they have been successful. There haven't been very many. I'm trying to remember what the context was, and maybe it'll come to me, but there have not been very many. And of course, people of my ilk and Todd's ilk talk often about the CFPB having this very expansive view of its jurisdiction and that it keeps pushing it. Well, you know, one potential challenge may be in this auto loan area that we talked about. I don't know that there's been a challenge yet, but, you know, auto dealers are exempt from the jurisdiction of the CFPB by statute. And so the CFPB trying to get at these loans that the auto dealers originate are going after the creditors, and, you know, in a way, someone might say, well, that's a disguised way of trying to evade the limit on its jurisdiction. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things the CFPB has done is it's made most of its law, so to speak, at this point through settlements. And sort of, you know, creeping out in, you know, larger and larger. So, for instance, they've defined abusiveness via settlements primarily with various parties. I'm not familiar with a lot of these cases, so there have been some settlements. I'm trying to remember, last month we talked about the Sprint case, and I cannot remember, Jerry, perhaps you recall, whether or not the Sprint case, was that a settlement or is that a an action that's being contested? Because there, that struck me as the CFPB reaching really to its apex in terms of claiming that Sprint was a payment processor for these apps that were being downloaded, and that was brought along with the FCC. But to date, I'm not familiar with other cases that have pushed on that. With respect to the issue raised in the ITT case that Jerry mentioned, the challenge, the constitutionality of the CFPB, I'm familiar with two other cases on that. One is the case that was brought up here in D.C. by in the Big Springs National Bank case, which is on appeal on the standing issue. The second was the Morgan Drexen case, in which a similar challenge was made to the CFPB. That was, I believe, also argued in the D.C. Circuit, but to the best of my knowledge and opinion, has not been handed down in that. And I was retained as an expert witness, in full disclosure, in advising on that case in at the district court. But I'm not sure where it stands right now.
Todd, the only other, I mean, you're absolutely right. Those, the telecommunications cases, that is still pending. That is not a settlement. And so you're right. That will probably be a defense by Sprint that it's not subject to the jurisdiction. Another one that's pending is the lawsuit by the CFPB against the law firm in Georgia, which the CFPB is arguing, even though law firms are exempt from its jurisdiction, is saying the firm was not acting as a law firm, but really as a collection agency.
Right. So this isn't directly on the question that Jody asked about, but yeah. So the only other case I'm familiar with that's right on with that is the Sprint case. So are you familiar with any, Jody?
Other than the ones that have been mentioned, those are at least one or two of those I was familiar with. And I think there might have been one other one involving, I want to say it was an Indian reservation. It was a couple of years ago.
Right.
Yes, those Indian reservation cases early on, right, may have had, those were, there were definitely jurisdictional questions raised there, and I can't remember the nature of them. Yes, the Indian reservation payday lending cases, right.
And didn't
thank you very much for the response.
Didn't the CFPB win those Indian cases, I want to say?
I think they did.
Yeah.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question from our callers.
David Emerson, society member in Berkeley, California. I've got more of a general question about the CFPB and whether a particular legal analysis has been done on the their jurisdictional authority and their implementations. The I mean, just part of the name involves consumer and protection. So there's this sort of notion that the consumers aren't able to protect themselves, so a regulatory agency must step in and protect them for them. But in general, and particularly in this payday lending business, is there an argument to be made that with sufficient disclosure demonstrated and with sufficient understanding by a consumer demonstrated and having a consumer be an adult competent, able to make decisions, is there an argument under freedom of contract or liberty of contract that there is, with those prerequisites, understanding and disclosure, that the consumer ought to be able to enter into these regardless of the regulation?
Yeah, I think and payday lending is a really good test of whether or not we're going to treat people like grown-ups, which is, we know some things about payday lending, which is, first, it is a very simple product. It has one price term. It's got a short-term duration. It's $15 per hundred. There's no tricks and there's no tricks and traps on payday loans, as Senator Warren likes to say about credit card issuers or even bank accounts. These are very simple products. Second, consumers know exactly how much payday loans cost. They may not be able to tell you the APR because the annual percentage rate on a two-week loan is irrelevant, right? They do know. One study by, I didn't co-author this, but my frequent co-author, Greg Ellyhausen, found that something like 98% of customers knew how much their last payday loan cost them. They know it costs $15 per hundred. We also know, based on research from Ronald Mann, that consumers accurately estimate how long it's going to take them to repay their payday loan, which is to say that they know that they're not going to pay it off in 2 weeks. But a clear majority, know whether it's going to take them 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever. So when they get into the loan, they know how much it's going to cost, they know how long it's going to be outstanding, and they understand all of the terms of the loan. So if there's ever been a product for which we have a question of whether or not we're going to just treat people with like grown-ups and allow them to make their choices, this is the product. The CFPB is not the Ace Cash Express case. They made a claim that the loans were abusive in that case because they were set up to force borrowers to roll over their loans. But again, they've shown no indication that that borrowers are not aware of what they're getting themselves into at the time they enter into the loan, and it goes with each of these products. Finally, what we also know is that people use payday loans because it's the least expensive option that they have at that moment. We may wish we lived in a world where everybody saved enough money to deal with an to be able to get an emergency car repair. But that's not the world we live in, right? Some people need access to short-term credit, and people who use payday loans are quite simply people who don't have credit cards. And so they're choosing between payday loans and pawn shops and overdraft protection and bouncing checks and all the fees that go with bouncing checks. And we may not like it, but when we look at how consumers act, given their limited choices, they seem to act in a way that is what an economist would say is rational, in the sense of minimizing their cost, and in particular choosing between, say, payday loans and overdraft protection. So when we take away payday loans, we get more use of overdraft protection, we get more bounce checks, there seems to be some evidence we get more evictions and utility terminations and the like. So we may be saving some people from a so-called debt trap, but we're forcing a lot of people into the hands of more expensive, less attractive options, or eventually into the hands of the loan sharks.
Jerry Lozier, anything on this point?
No, I deferred it to Todd, totally.
Well, let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are still open, wide open at this point.
I can just follow up, but has there been a legal challenge based on a constitutional liberty of contract made against the CFPB's practices?
not that I ever heard.
Not yet, no. So, And as as Jerry mentioned, apparently the CFPB doesn't even have to have actual flesh and blood human beings, as the Wall Street Journal editorial noted yesterday. The CFPB are collecting for fractions of people who they add up to be full people for purposes of their ally claim. So.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. If I read the article, the Wall Street Journal article correctly, their formula would indicate that person X has a 50% chance of being a minority and person Y has a 50% chance of minority. So together, that counts as one minority person for the terms of settling the claim.
That's right. So they each get half of a settlement check?
I don't know, but some very interesting questions that remain unanswered. Any closing thoughts from either of you? We've got a couple minutes left before we adjourn. If you'd like to express a final thought.
Yeah, my final thought is for those who missed the call last month, we did talk about the arbitration study, and as Dean mentioned, there will be a upcoming teleforum on that involving some other people, and there's continued activity around the arbitration study and comments coming out and that sort of thing. So we may have an update on that next month, but we did cover that in last month's call. If people missed that and wanted to go back and download last month's call, there was a substantial discussion of that, but we didn't talk about it this month because it came out basically the day before or the day of our call last month.
Jerry Lozier, final thought before we adjourn?
Just, isn't this a great country?
It is indeed, and let me thank you both once again for participating in this call. We will revisit these issues next month in our CFPB update, and as Professor Zawicki just mentioned, we'll have a special call in between now and then on this arbitration study. And he also mentioned, thank you for that, Professor Zawicki, that our teleform conference calls are recorded, so if you want to go back and revisit any of them, or if you missed any of them, you can find them on the Federal Society's website. Looking forward, our next scheduled call is tomorrow at 3 p.m., when again we'll be looking at the EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act. And Jerry, if you think the CFPB is guilty of overreach, tune into that tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time.
Okay.
But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.